We're back on the air. This is Radio Entrepreneurs. My name is Jeffrey Davis. I'm the host of the show. Thank you. At least I am this year. And we want to thank again our host, our wonderful host this whole month of the firm of Gray, Gray & Gray, and my co-host beside me, Rich Hershen, partner in the firm. Thank you, Rich.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. Thanks for broadcasting here.
Love being here. We're making plans already for another September tour.
Later this year, yeah.
Yeah,
We'll be here again.
That's good. It's good. Look at this. It's in his notes already.
Okay. He's doing a good job.
Chris,
the producer over there, never gets any credit on the air.
Let's give Chris some credit. It's 48 hours and counting.
Yeah.
Quit smoking.
Right.
We had a group intervention on the radio show.
Wow.
Everybody in the radio show got involved. He's up to 48 hours. We don't smell cigarettes today. You don't smell cigarettes,
no,
right?
No.
He's a good boy.
That's great.
Talking about taking care of people,
yes.
When I think of attorneys who take care of people, you actually are top of mind with me. And today we're going to talk about the financial exploitation of elders, which is actually something I do think about a lot. It's a sad topic, but it is an important topic, isn't it?
It's very important, and it happens so frequently. It's incredible.
Right. Yeah. Tell us more about it. I don't want to predetermine the agenda. I have my own agenda in that subject, so I don't want to start yet.
So feel free to ask me questions, but I'll start off by giving a couple of war stories.
Okay.
I represent a lot of families who have concerns because they have an elderly family member who seems to be isolated or seems to be making friends with perhaps a paid caregiver or a contractor. Perhaps it's the landscaper. Who knows who it is? But sometimes people come into the lives of elders when elders need care and when they need services and supports, and those people will befriend the elder and before long isolate the elder. And within time, there's concern that the elder's assets are slipping away in the hands of the caregiver. I had one of these situations in a town in Massachusetts that's a fairly wealthy town. And an elder was living alone. Her family members were out of state. She had no children, no husband. She had a niece and nephew who were out of state. And they would visit periodically a couple of times a year, and they made sure that she had home health aides and that she had care. One of her home health aides was also a psychologist, which was unusual to begin with. And another one was a person who had an interest in different athletic businesses. So that was also a little curious. And the family was a little nervous about why she had brought in these caregivers who had other types of jobs that weren't exactly nurse's aide type of jobs. But they let it go. They would visit periodically. Before long, they started to have concerns because these caregivers were starting to isolate her. And they realized, after retaining my firm, that the elder had purchased waterfront homes for each of these women and had changed her estate planning documents so as to make these two women her trustees. There were gifts that were made of cash. The two women were living off of this woman, this elderly woman, and she was of diminished capacity. She was of diminished physical capacity and diminished mental capacity. And we came in with a guardianship action, trying to have the niece and nephew appointed as guardians. And she fought it with the help of these two women who got her counsel. And it was a action, she had quite a bit of
There's
money.
No winners in this story.
There's no winners.
It's just sad all around.
There's no winners. We did, after 12 days of trial, it was a very highly contested trial, after 12 days of trial and competing medical experts, psychiatrists on both sides to determine whether or not she had capacity to make the gifts that she made and to sign the deeds that she signed and to sign the trusts and different estate planning documents that she signed. After 12 days of trial and dueling medical professionals, we did get a guardian appointed, but it was not family members. There was just too much controversy within the case to have family appointed, and the judge decided to appoint a neutral attorney to serve as the decision maker, both guardian and conservator. Ultimately, she passed away a few years later, and the action became an estate action because it was too late. All the documents, all the estate planning documents, had made dispositions in favor of these two caregivers who had come in years before and influenced her. They had influenced her to the extent that they had what's called in the law overmastered her independent will. And had it not been for them, she would have kept her longstanding estate plan in place, benefiting her niece and nephew and their children. But in this case, the estate planning documents left just about everything for these two non-related caregivers who came into her life at the very final years of her life and befriended her and made her dependent. So it became estate litigation. And in that estate litigation, we were able to turn back a lot of the dispositions. So what people don't realize is that in these undue influence and financial exploitation cases, if you've got a lawyer who is knowledgeable about this area of law and who is fast and takes swift action, you actually can undo wills. You can have wills nullified. You can have deeds revoked. You can turn back gifts. If somebody gives a gift of cash, you can disgorge it from the recipient and turn back gifts. You can turn back deeds, trusts, wills.
But there's a process, and it's not easy, I would assume.
It's an expensive process, too.
Right.
Yes, it is. It takes a lot of litigation.
And I assume that you'd have to be a fairly astute and sharp attorney to be able to work in this type of situation.
You need to know the law, and you also need to know the courts and have a sense for which judge you have. It's almost like poetry. You also need to understand family dynamics. You have to understand action and reaction, and you've got to pull it all together and make it work for you. You've got to have the right medical experts. Very often in estate litigation, you're looking at post-mortem type forensic evaluation of competency. The person's not alive anymore, to test them, to figure out, does this person have mental capacity to know what they're doing?
You know, I have a couple of questions. One, maybe the simpler of the two. Is it always the case the guardians are appointed are attorneys?
No. I happen to serve as guardian and conservator for a lot of people in this situation where they are victims of financial exploitation. But usually it's family members or somebody who's a trusted friend, clergy person, a relative. It usually is. It's the litigated cases that end up with the appointment of a neutral, disinterested, non-family guardian and conservator.
So what are things that can be done before it gets to the point of this litigation, before assets are stolen, for lack of a better term?
Let's say you were a middle-aged accountant and you were looking at these things.
Just for example.
Hypothetically,
exactly.
Right. So it's a great question. What can be done in advance? There are advanced steps that can be taken. It's very important for us in our younger years to appoint trusted people to serve as our agents under our healthcare proxies and trusted people to serve as our attorneys in fact, which is an agent under our durable powers of attorney, and to keep those documents, especially the durable power of attorney, with our lawyers so that they can't fall into the wrong hands or be abused, because these documents are quite capable of abuse. But if you appoint the right people and you put in protections within these documents themselves, then you're able to have the right people come in at the right time and make the right choices for an elder whose capacity is otherwise diminishing or diminished.
So, no, as I say, does that need to be in place? So, in these cases, is the elder still retaining the ability to make decisions? So, if you know, there was an aide that he or she did become good friends with and he or she decided she wanted to leave some of his or her assets, do they still retain that decision? Or in the scenario that you outlined, is there like a check and balance that before a decision can be made, someone else is kind of looking at it?
So, capacity waxes and wanes. Especially with dementia. Sometimes people have a good day or a bad day. They might be lucid or not. And in addition, people don't go from being fully competent, as we presumably are, to being incompetent in a day. So it's a great question. To what extent can a person who's elderly and who is dealing with diminished capacity, to what extent can they make some decisions still? And there are psychiatrists and geriatric specialists, neurologists, and different types of professions who can parse out what type of functional capacity a person has. So a person might not be able to make complex trust decisions, but they might still have enough capacity to sign a deed because the capacity to contract is different than the capacity to execute estate planning documents. Or a person might not be able to make complex medical decisions due to anxiety, due to mental incapacity, due to pain, medications, whatever it is, but might have enough and sufficient capacity to nominate a person to serve as healthcare agent to make those decisions for them. So the question, to what extent can an elder actually execute documents, make gifts, and transfer assets is a question that is entirely fact-dependent at the time, and at the time that an act is being undertaken. I have one case right now that has just settled where an elderly gentleman who had very good capacity did have a stroke. He was starting to lose capacity. He was in a nursing home right after the stroke because he needed a period of rehabilitation. But he didn't really have dementia. It was just a stroke-related. He was recompensating and recovering from the stroke. And his neighbor came into the nursing home a lot to visit him and to help him with physical therapy, and at one point took him to the bank so that he could transfer money into an account that was joint with her so she could help him pay his bills. And through time, within months, he had made some transfers into this joint account, diverting money that would have otherwise been in his estate, and ultimately at one point decided to take $500,000 out of the bank and bring it to a different bank because in his mind he wanted to make sure that it was FDIC insured, and he had too much money all held at one bank in his mind and he wanted to move it over. So he was going to go with his neighbor up the street a couple of blocks to deposit funds, and his capacity, he may have had capacity to do this. It sounded good enough to the bank teller, to the customer service person who was helping him with this transaction. Ultimately, he was incontinent at the bank and was embarrassed about it. He had the capacity to understand that he'd been incontinent and he was embarrassed. And he said to his neighbor, bring me back to the nursing home. She brought him back. He had her hold on to the $500,000 cashier's check that had been made payable to him or her, not him and her. And she deposited it into her own account that afternoon. The question became after his death whether this was supposed to be one of those joint account deposits that was to be used for his and his living wife. His living wife had a very severe dementia. She was in a nursing home as well. Whether these funds were supposed to have been deposited into a joint account to pay their bills at the nursing home, they were private pay, or whether this was in fact a gift. And there was testimony during depositions by the woman, the neighbor, that it was a gift. And it took quite a bit of litigation to settle this action.
Such sad stories.
Very sad.
Just sad stories. And you touch so many buttons inside of me.
Yeah.
Of clients, friends of family, my own family. It just... You know, to do what you do, you have to have such depth of knowledge, but such compassion for people. It's unbelievable. I have so much respect for you. I think you know that. I tell you that all the time.
Thank you.
You know, again, a stupid question before you go. When somebody's changing their estate documents, they're usually going to the person who formally writes those documents, aren't they? It could be, and a lot of times I would think that was an attorney.
Yes.
Wouldn't an attorney pick up on some of these things happening and have some obligation to notify people if they thought something was going on, not just listen to someone who maybe has dementia or is being manipulated by care workers?
Yes, this does happen. So what the undue influencer, the financial exploiter, will do is very often bring somebody to a new lawyer. So if I get a client who is new to me and I see that they have estate planning documents that were prepared by another firm, especially a firm that I know that's a very reputable firm, I'll be concerned. I'll have a concern. But lawyers have a duty to preserve attorney-client privilege. They have a duty to not disclose secrets and to not prejudice their client in any way. There is a rule that lawyers have to follow, an ethical rule, that allows an attorney to disclose only so much, very little, but only so much information as will protect their client without prejudicing their client. You can let out the smallest bit of information for protection. And I'm confronted with this, since I handle these issues frequently, I'm confronted with the debate and the internal strife over my professional responsibility as a lawyer and my ethical obligation to my client. And there's a push-pull to it. There is a check and balance, but it's a struggle to really figure out to what extent do I need to listen to what my client says he or she wants to do versus look at the situation and look out for potential signs of undue influence.
Rich, did
good stuff.
Rich, did I tell you she was amazing?
It really is. This is eye-opening.
I follow her on Facebook. I follow her on LinkedIn. I follow Lisa all the time. She's, you know, I think of some people, they're always playing, you know, division, you know, second division entrepreneurship and business. And I always think of her as division one. You know, she's an All-American and practicing at a level that just other people just dream about practicing. She's unbelievable. And I say that just totally sincere. You know, you are. You're an amazing person. And if somebody else wants to find you, and I don't know why they wouldn't, how would they find you?
So I can be found at Burns & Levinson in Boston. Mm-hmm. My phone number there is 617-345-3471. My name is Lisa Couquier, and my email address is lcouquier@burnslev.com. That's L-C-U-K-I-E-R at burnslev.com.
Again, welcome. Thank you for being on the show.
Jeff,
I wish you were here every. I wish you were here every month.
Thank you.
If
I'd
it were up to me, it would be my.
We could organize that, right?
I mean, can we do a group intervention and get you every month here?
Thank you. I would love to be here. Thanks for having me on your show again.
Okay.
You're so generous.
We're going to take a break. Remind everybody that we're in the offices of Gray, Gray & Gray. Thanks to Rich Hershen. Going to take a break. We'll be right back after these messages on Radio Entrepreneurs.